Hey everyone, and welcome to At the Letters for September 12th, 2024. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you, alongside Shai Davidi. Shai, how's it going?
I'm all right, Ben. How are you?
Doing pretty well here. As the final stretch of the regular season is upon us. Thanks to Christian Ryan for producing this episode. Also to Nick Andrade. Arden should be back next week. He's been grinding. He's off for this episode, but we have Shai here to break down the latest with the Blue Jays. So let's start with Bowden Francis Shai. I mean, this is pretty remarkable. I thought he was going to be a good pitcher going into this season, got off to a bad start, and man, has he made up for it, because this last stretch that he's been on has been historic. It's been incredible. Twice in the last month, he's taken a no-hitter into the ninth inning. What is happening here with Bowden Francis?
For the second time in four starts, Francis takes a no-hit bid into the ninth inning and has it broken up by a home run. But once again, that should not take away anything from what Bowden Francis is doing start after start. John Schneider is going to go to the bullpen now that the no-hit bid is gone. And once again, Bowden, don't hang your head. What you are doing is remarkable right now. Vladdy's giving him a standing ovation. The fans are as well. Boy, has he been a treat to watch these last...
Yeah, 0.40 whip in his last six starts, which is the lowest whip in a six-start stretch in Major League history. It is pretty wild. And I wouldn't say it's quite Dave Steeb-esque, but... Well, you didn't think about him in, was it 88, where in back-to-back September starts, he lost no hitters with two out in the ninth inning, also lost a perfect game with two outs in the ninth inning. But the fact that he's able to suppress contact or quality contact and generate these outs is, it's been pretty remarkable. And there obviously has to be some element of good fortune to this. You know, nobody really shuts down guy opposing hitters in this fashion as often as he has. But it's been really fun to watch. It's been a good story for a Blue Jays team that hasn't had enough of them this season. And especially when you start casting forward, he's obviously not going to be routinely carrying no hitters deep into games, you would think, but he does really, for the first time, look like someone who can be a consistent major league pitcher. And I think this was, the Blue Jays were hoping to see some version of this at the beginning of the year. It took a while for him to get there, some adjustments with his pitch usage, certainly a change in the way he approaches pitching and the consistency within which he manages to attack. But this is a really important development for the Blue Jays as you start casting forward to what 2025 looks like.
Right, because could he be Zach Eflin for the Jays? Could he be Seth Lugo? Like, no one's saying he's going to be Jacob deGrom, but could he be someone who avoids the barrel and is taking the ball for you consistently into the sixth inning, maybe into the seventh inning on a day that he's getting some, you know, some weak contact as he's been doing so far? I mean, that to me seems like a reasonable, optimistic projection for Bowden Francis. Not to say he's definitely going to be one of those guys, but that seems really within his grasp. He's showing that when he's really rolling, he can do that. And, you know, yesterday, what I was really struck by, and you and I were sitting in the press box along with her colleague David Singh, kind of watching this game and discussing it as it unfolded, and we're kind of looking at the radar gun. It's like 89 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour. It's such an old school start. He's striking out no one. He wasn't really missing bats yesterday, and he was just going and going. And John Schneider said afterwards he would have let him keep going at 120 pitches. It was such an old school start. And so from that standpoint alone, it's kind of a fun, refreshing counterpoint to what we normally see in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it was probably about the fourth or fifth inning. I turned to him like, he's sitting 91 right now with his heater. And you were kind of like surprised by it. I'm like, it was like, well, he's probably had some higher numbers. I'm like, no, he's topped out at 93. And that's actually his season average. So like his best pitch was his season average. So that's kind of telling you that it wasn't his A stuff. And he admitted that after the game. He said he felt pretty fatigued beforehand. He had a good night of sleep. His body didn't feel great. And like in a lot of ways, I think that's the piece that's most encouraging for the Blue Jays. Like him learning how to pitch when he doesn't have his best stuff, when he isn't necessarily at his best, understanding, as he said afterwards, that your stuff still plays. Like you still stay on the attack, put the ball in good spots. You can still get outs. And then, you know, when you have your A stuff, the way he did against the Angels in that eight innings of no-hit baseball, then you really see the power and how dynamic he could be.
Everybody in the ballpark knows what's going on. A couple of strikes now. Listen to them get louder. Better than 34,000 today. To left field. It's right at Lo Perfido, and the inning is over. Eight outstanding innings for Bowden Francis.
You know, I really like the way you framed it at the beginning. Like, I think right now, if you said to the Blue Jays, you can sign up for 150 innings with a 4.25 ERA from Bowden Francis next year. Like, are you not signing up for that right now?
Yeah, you're taking it.
Like, that seems like a not unreasonable outcome. Like, there are questions, like, can he hold his stuff that deep and for that many innings? And there probably will need to be some management along the way. But this is a big, strong dude. Someone who's really made a lot of progress. And I can't stress this enough. Like, this is a different pitcher than he was at the beginning of the season, right?
Yes.
Beginning of the season, it's fastball, curveball, and flipping an occasional slider, and then had this experimental splitter that really wasn't a thing. And then, you know, along the way, he's making changes, finds a grip with the splitter, evolves a little bit, develops this really good relationship with Brian Servin in AAA. They both come up around the trade deadline. And all of a sudden, he's like fastball splitter, slider is really effective, curveball usage is really smart in certain situations. The sinker is a useful pitch for him on occasions against left-handers. It's just a really different guy, like a varied guy with multiple weapons and a way to just really manage lineups. And so as much as like this, you know, 0.40 whip baseball is unsustainable, like there are pieces that you look at and say, okay, if the physical side holds up, there is a toolkit here that gives him the potential to be sustainable. For me right now, the biggest question around him is not whether his stuff will play or allow him to turn over a lineup three times. It's, can he physically hold up wire to wire and like give you 150, 160 innings?
Yeah. And it's really interesting because, so at this point, he's pitched 93, we'll call it, innings in the major leagues, plus another 20, we'll call it, in the minor leagues. So that's about 113 innings of professional baseball this season. And he's probably got two more starts. So let's say that gets to 125 for this season. I'm going to throw out a hot take here, Shai, and tell me if I'm like way off on this. But if he gets to 125 this offseason, he feels healthy going into the offseason. Next year, he's entering his age 29 season. To me, the gloves are off. Like, let him go as much as he wants. If he wants to, if he can jump from 125 to 180 next year and he's doing well, I'd be fine with that. I know it's not conventional. I know that you wouldn't normally sign up for like a 55 inning jump, but for a 29-year-old dude who's kind of old school and he's not throwing a million miles an hour where you sometimes have that higher risk of Tommy John. I mean, no pitcher's immune from that risk, but I would push him a little harder than I would some 22-year-olds.
I don't think that's an unreasonable take, right? Like the conventional wisdom, and look, conventional wisdom when it comes to pitching isn't very good, right? But as evidenced by the number of pitching injuries, especially this year. But conventional wisdom is like you're going to look for like a 20 to 25% year-over-year workload increase, right? For the sake of arguments, ending in like the 120, 130 range, you're looking at about, what is that, 30, tack on 30, 35 more innings, say. So that's taking you into the 155 range. Then from that range, is it, you know, can you say, oh, he's holding up, he's physically good? You can use the various measuring tools that you have to gauge workload and potential vulnerabilities. Yeah, maybe, you know, 170, 180 is within the realm. It's not, I don't think it's ludicrous by any stretch. I would say it's unlikely. And maybe more ideal is you're looking to get him to say 160, and maybe you're managing him a little bit more earlier in the season and then letting him push deeper into the year. But I think you're also just playing it out, and you know, maybe I think the position the Blue Jays would love to be in is that they have a starter who's optionable that they feel confident enough in to have him come up and make spot starts on occasions and give guys a rest as needed. And that way you don't have to get him to 180. It's great if he can do it. You want to let him do it, but you want to make him force your hand with that as opposed to you not having options and just doing that out of necessity.
Right. And ultimately those decisions are made week to week. It's not like you sit down and you press a button that says 180. It's you're managing that on an ongoing basis from the beginning of spring training until, you know, ideally the end of a playoff run. So it's not just so cut and dried. But I do think it's really significant to this Blue Jays team. And you know, as much as we're looking ahead here, I do want to cast back just for a moment and connect to what you said earlier with Dave Steeb, because this is a franchise that's only ever had one no-hitter in its history. And Bowden Francis now has come pretty close to adding a second one to the Blue Jays history books a couple of times, to the point that this stretch that he's been on, the only comparable in a weird way actually is Dave Steeb. Because you could say, for all the great pitching that the Blue Jays have had, whether it's Roger Clemens or Pat Henkin or Roy Halladay, or in more recent years, you have Robbie Ray winning a Cy Young. For all of those great pitchers that have come through here, the no-hit bids really have been Steeb and Steeb alone. And I know Halladay had won, but to do it multiple times, now Francis is in unique territory where it's really only him and Dave Steeb.
Absolutely. And just to pick at that a little bit, Ben, this is the 40th season of Blue Jays baseball, right? And you mentioned, like, they've had really good pitchers. The lack of no-hitters, and I don't have any data to support this. So I'm going to, you know, just make that clear that I'm just kind of pulling this out of air, and this is maybe like a more emotional reaction as opposed to anything. But it feels like the Blue Jays have just an oddly high number of close calls, right? So you've got Dave Steeb, and we talked about all his close calls. And then you had Roy Halladay losing one in the ninth with two outs on a Bobby Higginson home run. You've got Morrow, which may be the best pitched game I've ever seen and maybe the best pitched game in franchise history.
Was that 17 strikeouts?
17 strikeouts against the Rays. Just as dominant and overpowering as I've seen a pitcher.
Unbelievable.
It was just an incredible outing. And it's just this dumb bleeder that if Aaron Hill is positioned, like, honestly, 1 foot to the left, he's getting. Man. And it's a no-hitter. So you've got that one. Dustin McGowan was a phenomenal game. I think it was 2008. And I think Frank Thomas hit his 499th homer in that game as well. But you had Dustin McGowan take a no-hitter in the ninth, loses it on a Jeff Baker singer against Colorado. You know, obviously we've got Bowden Francis right now. It seems that there's a disproportionate number of close calls that, like, one of them had to have hit. And so
yeah,
it's really weird for Bowden Francis to have these back-to-back. And you can kind of see him smirking. I love the story John Schneider told of when he went to go get Bowden Francis in the ninth inning after the Lindor home run. Bowden Francis kind of smirked in his head. I guess we did it again, and then kind of walked off. But it's very odd. And I think that the whole thing, just when you look at it in the bigger picture within the scope of franchise history, certainly in the moment, this is unique. And it's been a really interesting and memorable part of the season. We haven't even mentioned, like, the 5 1/3 no-hit innings in that start against Boston.
Right.
When he looked like he might get, like, this stuff doesn't happen.
The guy's throwing one-hitters on a regular basis.
Yeah, he had his 7 innings of one-hit baseball in Anaheim. That it was a third-inning home run to Mickey Moniak, but otherwise there were no hits against him. This is just, it's super unusual. And so I'm assuming that teams are going to have some time to dig in on him a bit more over the offseason and have different attack plans for him next season. This stuff isn't this easy.
No.
But it's not like he was like Bowden Francis, like maybe a guy, and suddenly he's like the second coming of Dave Steeb. But maybe like the Blue Jays have really found something here. And I don't want to make like an sort of a heat of the moment, hot takey comment, but you don't fluke your way into this much no hit adjacent baseball. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't think that you do. And I'm not even going to ask you if it's sustainable, because everyone knows it's not. I mean, it's a fact. But it's more a question in my mind of, can he be a good major league starting pitcher? Which, if we dial the clock back 5 or 6 months, was a huge question and seemed at one point this season to have been answered in the negative. Now it seems like a much more reasonable idea that he could be a solid to average to above average major league starting pitcher, the kind of pitcher that teams regularly commit 3 years and $10 to $20 million for on the open market. Because you
so need... Ben, having said that, sorry to cut you off, let me ask you this, because I think it's really interesting, that point that you just made. But like, so right now for you, is he in the 2025 Blue Jays rotation? Like, you're in the front office right now, is he in the rotation? Yes. For you,
100%. Yes. How about you?
He's in my rotation, but I want a very, very good contingency plan.
I agree. But I would also say that even, like, let's say the Seattle Mariners, okay, best rotation in baseball. Your number four is Brian Wu. Your number five is Bryce Miller. You're laughing, right? You've got an amazing rotation. But even there, I would say you need a good number six. Because to me, pitchers get hurt, and so you always need a good number six.
Right. But I'm more of the... I'm thinking of it more in the, you have to be ready to make a move there. Like, you can't, like, there has to be some runway, absolutely, but I don't think that you can be married to it, just because like, we're still looking at small sample size stuff, right? And I think among the many lessons this year is that this was a Blue Jays team that just didn't have enough contingencies. And
they were too slow to move off of stuff that wasn't working, whether it was Vogelbach, whether it was Springer at leadoff. They waited way too long.
Yeah. And look, there are reasons that we've talked about all year for that. Part of it is lack of options. Part of it's a lack of flexibility. Part of it's, trying to trust the people that you have. I mean, there are a number of factors, and you know, I'm sure that we'll be doing tons of postmortem in the weeks ahead, so we can sort of break down some of those other elements a little bit more in depth down the line. But there, I think that this was a Blue Jays team that didn't have much flexibility, and they didn't have many fallback options. And I think as they're building out the rotation for next year, so you're looking at, you got your front three, we know, with Berríos, Gausman, and Bassett. And then, so you're putting Bowden Francis in the mix, and he's earned a spot.
Your four.
And then you're looking at Yariel Rodriguez, and you've got Jake Bloss, and you've got Alec Manoa on the horizon, maybe in July or August.
Adam Macko in the minors, maybe. Yesavage is probably like 20, 26.
I think if you're factoring them into your planning, then you're not going to be deep enough. Like, I think they need to add a starting pitcher, like somebody who's in your rotation. And then you're letting Francis and Yariel Rodriguez and Jake Bloss figure it out. And then if there's an injury or somebody needs some time or someone has to miss some starts or whatever, then you've got real options. Because like, the Blue Jays were just too naked this year, and they can spend, $10 million on a starter and have that strength, because like, that's still going to be the pillar of this team. You know, I think there's a debate to be had. Like, should you just say, well, we'll figure it out with the stars that we have and we'll put everything else in the bullpen? Like, that's a reasonable discussion, a reasonable take. I just think that the value of starting pitching, how hard it is, and just the way that the Blue Jays have been constructed, that if you don't have that stability out of the rotation, then you're really chasing your season.
I agree. And I think they need to get more. And I think that, what we saw, we'll get to the bullpen later, but what we saw last year was they had a good bullpen in 2023 and they did not augment it in the offseason. There were not, three minor league invitees, and, there certainly weren't prospects bubbling up through the system. And I don't want to say it was complacency, because it wasn't complacency, but there wasn't at the same time enough support coming through. And so when those existing players regressed and took big steps back, then the entire pitching staff struggled as a result, and it cost the team big time. So you can't afford to just assume that, okay, we're good just because we were good 1 year, that it's going to carry over into the next year. And so I think specifically with the rotation, totally agree with you that they need to add. And to me, it's more in the number five spot, and you make Yariel Rodriguez prove that he belongs in that rotation. If not, he can start the season in the bullpen, no problem, or someone's hurt and he's your number five. You know, we all know how these things go. Maybe, you know, who knows what direction it takes, but I still think there's room for a starting pitcher 100%.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think when you mentioned sort of the bullpen and how locked in they were there and sort of not augmenting it, you know, one thing we talked about this in spring training, or maybe just before spring training, about how they didn't have enough flexibility in that bullpen in terms of guys they could option and how that was going to end up potentially being an issue. And the way that it ended up becoming an issue is that when guys were struggling, they were locked in to a certain degree with who they had.
Yeah.
And then some of the fallback plans, they just didn't pan out the way that you thought. Like Nate Pearson was on the bubble and he was supposed to be a depth piece. Or like, okay, but Nate Pearson could take a step forward and all of a sudden he can be a dude. And, you know, Zach Pop's made some adjustments and maybe Zach Pop will finally unlock all the ability. And then Hagen Danner was knocking on the door and Connor Cook was knocking on the door. And just so many of those guys either didn't perform well or went backwards or got hurt. And then when, you know, as soon as you saw that Jordan Romano wasn't healthy in spring training and Eric Swanson was hurt and they were rushing back to get ready, like, that's not a good thing. And, you know, Kevin Gausman rushed to get ready and obviously not a reliever, but he, after suffering some shoulder issues and then he chased his season.
Yeah.
I think there are a couple lessons. Obviously, one, spring training does matter for pitchers as much as everybody hates how long that it is. Like it is important. But two, there was no roster flexibility in that bullpen where they could make moves or try different things. And by the time that you did have the space to do that, well, you know, it was bringing in the Jose Quases of the world, and that's not a good outcome. So it's amazing how much that derailed. Like, you know, they went from sort of like being hoping from your best case scenario to probably like your absolute worst case scenario, right? Like value going to zero on Meza and Swanson and Jimmy Garcia getting hurt and, you know, Romano getting hurt and the value essentially disappearing on him. Like it's honestly incredible how that played out. Like, incredible in a bad way, how it played out.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's been bad. It continues to be bad. If anything, it's getting worse. I mean, the bullpen is just, even their good relievers now are struggling because Chad Green is probably looking the worst that he has all season. We'll get to that in the second part of the podcast here. But I do want to circle back before we take a break just on the Francis no-hitter, because, you know, just to pull back the curtain a little bit, like the idea of covering a Blue Jays no-hitter, obviously not something that you or I has ever done, because the last time it happened was 1990. But, you know, it's kind of funny because, speaking personally just on the no-hitter stuff, I happen to have been at a lot of Blue Jays no-hitters where they have been no-hit. And so, you know, I was there when Justin Verlander no-hit them, James Paxton no-hit them, when Matt Manning and the Tigers no-hit them, and then this year when Ronel Blanco and the Astros no-hit them. So I've seen the Blue Jays get no-hit four different times. And I got to admit, it would be kind of cool to cover it on the other side and to see and to cover a no-hitter where the Blue Jays are actually the ones doing the no-hitting. I think for fans, that would be something that really resonates in a season that's otherwise been so frustrating. So I think Bowden Francis is probably very good at kind of staying composed, staying calm, you know, staying grounded as all this unfolds. But I do think it's a missed opportunity for a fan base that could have used a nice story.
Oh, for sure. And I don't have the Blanco and the Tigers one that you have over the past couple of years, but I could, you know, I've got Verlander, I've got Paxton, and Yeah. And I've got so many of the close calls, right? Again, the Brandon Morrow one was incredible. The Dustin McGowan one was incredible. I can't remember how many times I was covering a Roy Halladay game and I'm like, oh yeah, this really has a no-hit feel to it. And it's crazy that he didn't get it until he ended up going to the Phillies, which is obviously part of the shame of, you know, Roy Halladay's tenure with the Blue Jays. The number of close calls, again, it's so unusual. And like you see them happen like relatively often,
yeah,
in Major League history, right? Like the obviously perfect game is way more rare, and like the only feat that's rarer than the perfect game is the four home run game. And so
right,
that one you would think that, especially with the guys hit the way guys swing nowadays, that you'd see maybe a couple more of those. But like no hitters, they happen. And for the Blue Jays to have one in 48 years with the caliber of pitchers that this organization has had is just a strange anomaly to me.
Yeah, no, 100%. Before we step aside here, any more thoughts on Bowden Francis, starting rotation, no hitters, anything else along those lines?
If you're kind of casting forward right now, but where the Blue Jays might be best positioned, I think you'd look at the rotation and say, this is still probably the best area of depth right now for the franchise in terms of both established players and some players coming up, some depth. You know, the Alek Manoah, how Alek Manoah may factor into 2025, if at all. You know, right now I'm thinking of him a little bit the way I thought about, or the way Hyunjin Ryu ended up playing out for the Blue Jays last year, where there was this possibility, he's there, he's getting ready, and suddenly there's a need, and there he is, and it just all lines up perfectly. And maybe that's what happens with Manoah next year. But that's an interesting piece there, because if Manoah was trending the way we thought he was trending before he got injured, that's not an insignificant piece. That's a very, very significant development. But there's a lot of if around there, and it's still a long way to get to that point. But I just think that's one story off in the distance that could have a more significant impact right now that we can't really see.
Yep. And the last thing I would point to is just the question of health, because, okay, 2023, the rotation, the health was like unblemished. It was ideal. This year, Manoah did undergo Tommy John. That's a significant setback. However, otherwise, the Jays actually, from Kikuchi to their current rotation, they have been, knock on wood, pretty healthy. And as you move ahead, you can never assume health. You obviously work toward it, but yeah, they need to be prepared for contingencies beyond just that starting five. And that's where we get to the importance of adding depth. So yeah, we will see where that leads. For now, we'll step aside for a moment here on At the Letters, but we still have to get to the big picture of this team, their direction, how they might approach solving that bullpen, and many other questions with Shai Davidi as we continue on At the Letters. Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Welcome back to At the Letters here on September the 12th, 2024. Bo Bichette, Vlad Jr., front office, the bullpen, the offseason. Just a few little topics to get too shy as we jump into the second half. Yeah, this should be just a quick little 5 minutes, get you on to the rest of your day. I think these really are huge questions for the team. And you had a great piece this week up with comments from Bo Bichette that were, I think got a lot of people fired up, and I think understandably so, when you heard Bo saying that he wants to be here. He wants to win a World Series with Vlad. He wants to be here long term. I mean, that's a significant development, and I won't, you know, make you sort of rehash that conversation, which I'm sure our listeners have come across so far, but it ties to a lot of different things. If Bo Bichette wants to play with Vlad, well, are they going to extend Vladdy? And if they're going to seriously talk about extending Vladdy and or Bo Bichette, who's making these decisions? Because these are big decisions, probably the kind of decisions that require ownership level clearance when you're talking about this kind of commitment. So where do you think it all stands? And this is a super broad question to throw at you, but tying together Vlad, Bo, the front office, what is your read on these elements because they are so significant for this franchise?
Yeah, I mean, like, I wish that you would just ask the serious questions and the hard questions, Ben. I've said this a few times and I've thought about this and talked to different people about it, but I don't think we're being dramatic when we say this is one of the biggest turning points in the franchise that's coming up, right? So you've got, at the same time, the contracts of the team president and CEO and the two cornerstone players who are just about to enter their peak years as players in Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., all expiring at the same time, along with the general manager who has come under significant fire for a difficult season this year with two more seasons left on his contract and a farm system that is improved since the trade deadline, but still not where it needs to be, on the heels of a $400+ million renovation of the Rogers Center that needs to start returning some revenues. So if you're trying to look at things holistically, those are all the elements that are at play right now. And then the challenge, and I wrote about this at some point, maybe around the trade deadline, is that they're all interconnected. You're not just worrying about stadium revenues without thinking about the state of the ball team. And you're not just extending Bo and or Vlad without making a commitment to a major direction. And you can't do that without saying, okay, well, we're putting or maintaining full faith in our president and CEO and our GM to continue to run the team, because you're not giving these guys contracts that run a decade plus, and that's in all likelihood what it's going to take. And then just saying, well, maybe I'm out in a year and you're saddling someone else with, a decade or so of two players that they may or may not want because they may want to go in a different direction. So the fact that all these things are interconnected makes the order of operations somewhat difficult. Like, I think the place where you probably start with, okay, where are things at with the leadership? And that's, Mark Shapiro and then afterwards Ross Atkins. And whereas I would say that right now, I would have thought that in June, July, that I would have thought there was a pretty reasonable likelihood that we'd see a change at general manager. And at this point, I don't think anything's definitive yet, but I believe the path is much clearer for Ross Atkins to continue as GM now than I certainly would have a couple months ago. And, I think some of that will be, Mark Shapiro having to make some decisions. I don't know this, but I think that his situation is not necessarily front burner. I think that if he wants to remain here, there's probably an appetite for him to continue onwards, and we'll see where that goes. And, I don't know that anything is certain. There's still a lot of things that are being decided and will be decided still in the weeks to come. So, again, everything I'm saying is subject to change, and just maybe I don't have the right info, but that's my read of where things stand right now. So I think you could have some reasonable stability there potentially, and then that would give them the sort of the rope to sign the kind of deals that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette would require to continue onwards. So there are pathways for all that. Now you get to the next step. Okay, so let's say that Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins are coming back and they want to extend both those guys. Well, you've got them under club control for 25. So do you punt that to the end of the offseason and say, hey, let's just focus on other offseason business And then we'll figure it out with those two once the winter ends. Or do you say, you know what? We need to know which way this is going. And so in October, let's lock this down. You guys say you want to stay. We want to keep you. Let's hammer it out. And then, you know, one way or the other, like, we're going to be able to find a sweet spot or we're not. And then that informs the direction you go based on whether you can lock them in or not. So, I mean, if it was my call to make, I would try to do it in October. Because yeah. The other thing that happens too is, so if you extend those guys, then you're going to the free agent market and you're saying, yeah, come join Bo and Vlad for the next decade. And all of a sudden lot more appealing than, hey guys, come join Will Wagner and Leo Jimenez for a decade. Right. And that's not
catching disrespect from Shy.
But that's, and I don't mean that, you know, to diminish the other two, but it looks a lot different and you're a different team with those two guys locked in and in place. And so that would be the approach that I would take. And then again, if you're just not going to be able to find common ground, then you have to say, okay, you know what? We can't afford to go into 25 with both these guys unsigned. So are you trading one? Are you trading both? Are you at least taking a good look at what you can get so you know what the market might look like at the trade deadline? I just think having that information earlier is better and yes. would allow you to really set a path forward. So,
yeah,
I mean, all those factors, I don't know that there's necessarily a strategy on any of that just yet. You know, the Blue Jays are making some changes in their, on the player development side already. One of their top pitching developers and Corey Popham as they've parted ways with, and the Blue Jays are still figuring out what they're going to do with that position. There may be other changes as well. I think the Blue Jays are taking a very, very long, hard look at how they develop that their player development system, particularly on the pitching side, and are trying to decide what they haven't been good enough at and how they can address those shortcomings. There are a lot of things happening beneath the surface, but a lot of things are going to have to happen above the surface too in the coming weeks and months. And the ramifications for that are going to be extremely wide ranging.
I think you're right to identify that this stuff has to happen in sequence, because even, and this is getting ahead of ourselves, and I actually want to go back. So, you know, we'll circle back on some of this stuff. But even with like a Juan Soto, right? If you decide that you're going to pursue a Juan Soto to any degree, you have to be prepared to wait until Scott Boras is ready to put ink to paper on that Juan Soto deal. And Scott Boras sometimes takes his sweet time. And that's part of his method. There, you know, we could have a whole other podcast about Scott Boras, but the fact is you have to be willing to wait on someone else's timeline. So you need a strategy. You need to have a plan. And that starts with the front office. And it starts with whether Ross Atkins is going to be coming back as the general manager. Because let's face it, a month ago when Mark Shapiro was asked about this, he left himself room to go in either direction. And a year ago when Ross Atkins was, you know, taking questions from the media and after the Jays left the postseason, Mark Shapiro then comes in a few days later to discuss it, put out a few fires of his own. At that point, Mark Shapiro calls Ross Atkins's resume undeniable. He's speaking very, very highly of Ross Atkins. I think it got to a point this summer where Mark Shapiro, at the very least, was looking really long and hard at what Ross Atkins has done, Ross Atkins's work and his resume and where the state of this franchise is, and a couple really key categories, and making an assessment. And I don't know where that assessment is going to lead, but at some point they are going to have to make a decision moving forward. Because I mean, if you're not going to have Ross Atkins, you certainly need to have time to undertake a GM search. And there's another factor too, right? From an organizational standpoint, a GM search would be a huge amount of effort and work, and it would be a huge priority. So do you want to do that? Or is there actually a case to be made for using the month of October to restructure your pitching to, you know, maybe make an extension approach at someone like a Vlad Guerrero Jr.?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the point you make about the need for a GM search and how that would play out and just what a drain that is. It's not only that that takes time. It's not like you unless all this, everything's already in place. Like, I suppose you could promote James Click and hire him on an interim or a permanent basis, whatever you want to do, and then have it be relatively seamless. But if you're bringing anyone from outside this front office in to take over that position, like, that person would need time to develop, to execute a strategy, to get to know the organization. And you can't just throw someone into the middle of all these major inflection point decisions and say, hey, figure it out in a week and a half. Like, that's not a good way to operate. That's not setting anyone up for success to make these pivotal calls. And so, the way that I'm kind of thinking about it is that the longer that there isn't a change with Ross Atkins, the more likely it is that he's coming back. And really, if you were going to make some sort of change, it should have happened late August, early September, right? Because that gives you the time
to totally agree.
Yeah, do a bit of a search, give that person some time to get to know the organization, formulate some plans. They have October to get everything ready and then be ready to attack as soon as the World Series is over and the market opens up. So when you put all those pieces together, it seems increasingly likely. And then again, there don't seem to be signs beneath the surface of imminent change. That could always, again, it could always happen. Maybe it's just being hidden extremely well, but as of now, you don't really pick up on those signs. And so, you're going into next season with presumably with the same leadership. And so then from then on, okay, so that's settled. Then you're making the other decisions.
Right. And I think that's such a good point that the longer it goes on, the more likely it would seem that Ross Atkins continues in place as the GM. Because I also think that as an organization that prides itself on being inclusive and having a representing a diverse city and country, you don't want to just bypass the Selig rule and not interview a wide range of candidates, to replace Ross Atkins with James Click and not even to give anyone else the chance to interview for that job wouldn't be a good look. You want to be thorough anytime you're making a change of that magnitude and to give candidates from all backgrounds the chance to interview there. So, that wouldn't be a great look. And so, this isn't to say that Ross Atkins is beyond criticism or that he's had a good year, because he hasn't had a good year and this team isn't good enough. And that's a reflection of the moves that he has made and the draft picks that have come up through a farm system that he's been overseeing. So all of that can still fall on Ross Atkins. This is more to describe the state of things than it is to offer a ringing endorsement of the decisions that may or may not be made.
Right. This is just how things appear to be playing out. And an interesting comp I was thinking a little bit about recently, after a conversation I had with some people, was where the Blue Jays were at the end of the 2014 season. And you may remember there was some pretty good discontentment at the trade deadline, voiced publicly by Jose Bautista and Casey Jansen, but spoken about by others privately as well, that the Blue Jays didn't do anything at the deadline and they didn't make a push when they were in contention. There was a slate of injuries in August. They collapse. They fall out of the playoff race. They end up watching the Baltimore Orioles celebrate a clinching of the AL East at Camden Yards after they beat the Blue Jays. And the Blue Jays front office at the time, Alex Anthopoulos and assistant GM Tony LaCava and Perry Manessi and Andrew Tinnish were sitting in the box afterwards and just discussing with one another, like, what happened? Like, the Blue Jays felt they were a better team talent-wise than the Orioles were that season, but the Orioles got there and they didn't. And there was a lot of soul-searching both after the 13 season, after the 14 season, and they decided to do a lot of things very differently in the year after that. And maybe this is this front office's version of that. I mean, like, if this story is going to have a happy ending, if assuming that, you know, the stuff that we're speculating on right now ends up coming to be, for this to end well, this season has to be a learning season that creates the necessary change. And, you know, what happened in the postseason last year, that spurred some change, but obviously not enough. And there has to be a real, it's not just we change a few people and everything's all right. There needs to be significant change in a number of different areas. It's in player development system. It's in the draft, which I think that the model changed a little bit this year, and the Blue Jays seem to do some different things this year. And we'll see down the line whether that worked out or not. But it needs to be in how they evaluate certain players and some of the bets that they make and what they choose to invest in and how they spend. And all these things need to be evaluated because this franchise is in a very precarious spot right now. Like there is very clearly a pathway for this team to contend again. The bar to get a wild card is really low, right? Like the New York Mets stripped down last year at the trade deadline and didn't spend big in free agency, but made a few clever moves. And all of a sudden they look like they're a team with some that can get to the playoffs and actually do some damage once they get there. You know, that bar is low and the Blue Jays have some talent, but if they're not maxing it out and they haven't maxed out their talent at any point during this reign, I think maybe only 21 was that, like, that's clearly their peak season of this current core. And they fixed the bullpen too late. And they had an opportunity to get Raisel Iglesias at the deadline that year. They didn't do it. And that has been that season should haunt this franchise the way a few other years that, you know, 2008, 2014 a little bit, obviously 1987, these are 85 in the ALCS. Like, these are seasons that should haunt and will haunt the franchise for a long time. But why have they not been able to max out? What are some of the issues that have prevented this from happening? And we've talked about this. We've made this point a number of times in recent years, and it obviously there isn't an answer. And I don't want to just fluff it off as one of those things or randomness. There could be some of that to that, but you can't leave things to chance either. And so I do think that there's a lot of soul searching that needs to be done. And I do think some of that's taking place right now as well. I will point that out. But, you know, for that to be done well, kind of the way that the Blue Jays did that over from 14 to 15, you know, that ended up paying off. And so the Blue Jays have an opportunity to draw some lessons here that pay off in the years down the road, but, you know, they have to do the work first and draw the right conclusions.
You mentioned the Mets there, and this week John Gibbons was in town along with the Mets as their bench coach. Of course, always great to see Gibby and catch up a little bit with just a legend in Blue Jays history. But he got to that point of being a legend where, you know, we're seeing like John Gibbons jerseys in the stands. And of course, everyone loves Gibby and as they should, considering the impact he made on this franchise. But there was a time that he was not well-liked. And there was a time that he was a source of a ton of frustration for this fan base. Now, he overcame that, as did Alex Anthopoulos, by winning. And John Gibbons is well aware of that. And he said in the dugout this week, he's like, winning kind of shifted things. And that's what the Blue Jays haven't done enough of. And if Ross Atkins and John Schneider and Mark Shapiro get the Blue Jays through to, you know, a World Series and win a World Series, or even win, you know, let's start with a playoff game because they haven't done that since 2016, you know, that would change the perception, and rightfully so. Because, you know, in the meantime, there's a lot of frustration around someone like Ross Atkins. And I think, like, fans sometimes think like that Ross Atkins is like that they would do a better job as the GM than Ross Atkins. And, you know, that's a fun take to have. But looking at this big picture, Mark Shapiro's belief in Ross Atkins is a huge decision. And to this point has shaped the way the Blue Jays have played and operated for the last 8+ years, 9 years almost. So if he continues in that role, that would continue to be a huge, huge decision for what it means for the Jays going forward.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. And you know, the one point I'd add, it's going to be like from a bit of a different angle, but like this franchise is very fortunate to have as passionate and engaged a fan base as it does, right? Like,
yeah,
we've talked about this, how we're always getting stopped and people are having different conversations and people have questions, and like people really care. Like even in this season, like people really care, they're aware, they're engaged, they're watching, obviously not in numbers as they have in the past, but like, and with attendance, because there's a lot of pre-buys, you often don't see an impact until the season after when you have this type of season, but people are still coming out in numbers that you wouldn't necessarily expect for a team that's had this kind of season. So this fan base, like, you can't take it for granted and you can't let it slip away, right? The Blue Jays did that once in the 90s when there was a 30,000 person waiting list for season tickets. The strike happened. The Blue Jays struggled. They had indifferent ownership of Interbrew at the time, and the franchise spun and attendance dwindled, and it took until 15-16 for it to really come back. And so the Blue Jays are still riding that momentum. They still have that engagement. If they take that for granted and just think, okay, well, we'll be okay, that's a bad risk to take, because like the degree of engagement is super important in this day and age, and there's a lot more competition. It's a lot harder to keep eyeballs. So, you know, how do you factor that into some of the decisions as you make moving forward? You know, you still have to make difficult decisions that are best for the franchise, which your fans can't always see in the longer term, because understandably they want the immediate return, the immediate result. And that's completely fair and understandable. But that's going to be a delicate line. And I think that's a piece of the decision-making process that doesn't get talked about enough. Because, you know, we can kind of like scale it back and try to, you know, just describe it as objectively as possible. But there is a subjective piece to this for the people who are paying the bills. And how you manage that is going to be a really under-examined element of the Blue Jays in this offseason.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, too, it's worth just appreciating, even especially as people in the media, just how dialed in Blue Jays fans are. I mean, we're creating articles or podcasts, whatever the case, having conversations that people watch and consume. And it's phenomenal to have people so dialed in on a team that's out of it. They've been out of it for months and months. And yet, you know, we're seeing people at the ballpark, running into people at airports, running into people on the road, you know, at the grocery store, whatever the case, right? At the farmer's market, you know, I'm buying kale. I'm talking about the Blue Jays, right? Like there is a real, real appetite for information about this team and for this team to be good. And people want a contender. They deserve a contender. It hasn't happened this year, but I would say too, like for anyone who's listening to us talk about Ross Atkins and like, okay, maybe he's going to be back. I'm not sitting here to try to defend Ross Atkins, but I will say, just as like a counterpoint, it's worth remembering that it's not like he's incapable of making good moves. This offseason was a disaster. This season's been a disaster. It's a failure. But this is also someone who signed Marcus Semien to a one-year deal, signed Robbie Ray to a one-year deal. He wins the Cy Young, trades for Steven Matz, trades for Teoscar Hernandez. Now, he also traded Teoscar for Eric Swanson. That's a disaster. So he makes bad moves. He makes good moves. This is going to happen in the course of 8 or 9 years as a GM. But there is a pathway for this team to be good next year, and that's what fans deserve.
Yeah, for sure. And look, there will be lots of time to litigate the Ross Atkins reign and one way or the other once we get definitive word over who's going to run this team in 2025 and who's going to run this offseason. So, you know, we can kind of do the deep dive then, but it's never it's never just one-sided, right? Like people who look back at JP Ricciardi's reign and say, oh, it was terrible. Well, I mean, it actually wasn't. Like, they did a lot of really good things. And it wasn't good enough, but there are circumstances around that. And, you know, he got enough belief in what he was doing that Roy Halladay signed below market extensions, not once, but twice, because he believed he wanted to win here. He got Vernon Wells extended for what was then considered well below what he was going to earn in free agency. He convinced, like for the first time since the, you know, basically Roger Clemens signing, big name free agents like BJ Ryan and AJ Burnett to come here. He got Troy Glaus to waive a no trade clause to come join the team. And the Blue Jays put up some good seasons. And then, you know, really the one fateful call that he made in 2008, where the Blue Jays hired Gary Denbo as their hitting coach instead of Dwayne Murphy, who was in the system. And, you know, the Blue Jays didn't hit for half a season, ended up leading to the firing of John Gibbons, the return of Cito Gaston. The offense got going. They made a run, but they couldn't get back there in time. And they ended up squandering what was the best pitching staff in the American League in 2008. So, you know, these reigns, they're never universally good. They're universally bad. I guess maybe you can say, okay, look, if you're a Raptors fan, you look at maybe the Rob Babcock era and say, okay, that was an unmitigated disaster. Like nothing good that came out of that. But it's very rare that there isn't gray. And I think there's gray in this tenure too. And so, I mean, you know, again, there'll be time to litigate this down the road. If it happens, we'll see what the final call actually is. But it's going to be, I think, again, it's bigger than just this one call. Like there are a number of decisions that are all interconnected. And so this decision will lead into decisions on Bo and Vlad, which will lead into decisions on organizational direction, which will lead into decisions on subsequent player moves. Like that,
yeah.
This is not one thing. Everything is interconnected right now.
It's really fascinating because I think with Vladdy, the leverage has gradually shifted to him to the point that, you know, a Devers comp, you know, would seem to be a pretty fair comp. And you know, that's, we're talking $300 million plus here for a first baseman. That's, you know, a significant investment to consider. And I like the idea of potentially having those discussions before Soto signs, because as you were saying before, then that can create some clarity for free agents and it can let everyone know, as well as giving yourself some cost certainty, because, well, $350 million is a lot of money. It's probably not as much as what Vlad Jr. would cost if he replicates this year in 2025.
Smokes this ball to center field. Pilar back. It is gone. Number 27 for number 27. And it is 3-0.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. And I do think that if you're, from a timing perspective, if you're Vladimir Guerrero Jr., you may very well want to wait for Juan Soto to sign, because now that's a comp for what elite mid-20s free agents, elite offensive player free agents get, right? And that drags your market up. And, you know, When I wrote it this week a little bit about the first base market and Pete Alonso and how his contract is going to be really important for first baseman in the year to come. And if you kind of look at contracts for first baseman, you know, they've really plateaued, right? It's like you got the peak was the Miguel Cabrera $248 million deal, which began in the 2016 season. Yeah. You had Pujols doing $240 million at the 2011 winter meetings. That year is also when Joey Votto did his $225 million extension.
That's a while ago now.
Yeah, sorry. Votto was in 2012, the same year Prince Fielder did his $214 million deal.
Yeah.
And then you look at the biggest contracts for first baseman in this decade. You've got Matt Olson's $168 million extension with Atlanta and Freddie Freeman's $162 million free agent deal with the Dodgers, right? So, like, for Vlad, it's going to be interesting to see how the Blue Jays handle that with Vlad, because they could say, like, look, no first baseman has ever gotten more than $248 million. So where do they think that number starts? And I definitely think Vladimir Guerrero's junior camp, and rightly so, would look at Juan Soto and say, well, you know, Juan Soto is 1A and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. slots in just behind him.
Absolutely. And that's totally fair. And I think that, like, my personal belief on this, and I've written about contracts for a long time, thought about baseball contracts for a long time, dating back to the MLBTR days. You know, I just don't think it's so much about position as it is about age for these guys. And the reason that Vladdy is going to be comped to Soto and to Devers as opposed to, let's say, Pete Alonso is because the age. And so that puts Vlad Jr. in an incredible position, as he should, because what he's selling to teams is prime seasons of age 26 to age 31, where Aaron Judge is 32 right now. He's still hitting 50 homers a year. So Vladdy on his next contract, he might be selling 5, 6, 7 prime seasons, and that should be paid at an elite level.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. I just think that, you know, how comps work in the baseball business, and one side will pick out a comp that's more comparable to it. The other side will say, oh no, we think that these comps are far more appropriate. And that's how the sides will frame the negotiation. Right. And I do think that the Blue Jays will have some pause about how they reset the first base market. You know, and here's an element I'm just thinking of right now, but I wonder, like, how Scott Boras might look at sort of Pete Alonso's free agency there. Like, would he want to see whether Vladimir Guerrero Jr. extends first and then tries to draft Alonso on what Vlad's number is? Or would, you know, like, would the Blue Jays look at sort of Alonso's, wait to see Alonso's number and say, well, hey, you know, this is more relevant to where Vlad goes. So I think that's an interesting dynamic, because, like, their salaries have mirrored one another. They've almost been arbitration partners in a sense, because they've often been the prime comp for one another in what was in a term that Pete Alonso used, which I really liked, a comp desert for first baseman of their ilk. There's just a lot of dynamics there that are super interesting from a contract nerd perspective, which, you know, both of us are. this is also, like, there are pieces of this that are far more significant from a franchise perspective that, you know, have to be factored into, like, what Vlad's value to the franchise and his connection with the fans and how popular he is. Like, he's somebody that you want to watch play, right? His at bats are always entertaining. Like, he's got a great energy to him. There's a joy to him. Like, he's fun, right? Like, that's what you want in a player. Like, there's a magnetism to him that is really valuable. How do you define that? How do you put a number on that? That's for somebody smarter than me to decide, but that's definitely a piece that matters here, because, like, you know, you've got a building that you need to fill, right? And the amenities are great, but the product has to be there too.
It has to be. And I to me, honestly, like, I personally, I really enjoy watching Vlad Guerrero Jr. play. I think from, like, a, you know, dollars in the contract perspective, I don't know that it actually necessarily shifts things that much. Because, like, let's say someone like David Ortiz, who's gregarious and beloved, you know, compare him to, like, Jim Thome, who's more, like, quiet and understated. But, you know, they both produce. They're both going to get paid. They're both going to be really, you know, coveted players. So I think it's mostly about the production on the field. But for the Blue Jays, Vladdy has more value than he would to, you know, the Twins. Not that the Twins are going to sign him, but, you know, to pick a different team. And yeah, I think that just to touch on the Boris thing real quick, I think what Boris wants is Guerrero Jr. to be extended, because Boris always wants to have the top free agents every offseason. He doesn't like it when someone else does, and he obviously doesn't rep Vlad Jr. So I think that he wants Vladdy out of the way and like off the market, but maybe on a deal that he can sort of like take a snipe at and say that he would have done better. I think that's probably Scott Boris's like plan A on this one. But
Scott Boris wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do that, would he?
He would never snipe someone. No. So I think that's pretty fascinating. Anything else on Vladdy before I want to touch on the bullpen real quick before we step away here?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like that's got to be the first order of business, right? When the offseason begins. And you know, I can definitely see the Blue Jays trying to say, hey, we'll get to this in January, February. Let us try to make the team around you better in the interim. But I wouldn't want to know where I stood with him and whether that was going to get done. And then that would allow me the knowledge to operate moving forward. I wouldn't want to leave that second. And I also just think it changes your positioning in the market when you go to players. Players see that Vlad and/or Bo are committed for a number of years. That changes their outlook. They're like, okay, this team's definitely going to continue to go for it. Whereas if it can be pulled apart, it's like, well, who knows what this is a year or two from now.
And it changes your position with Vlad too, because think about this offseason. They go to arbitration with him. I'm not saying it's contentious, but it's never great. And this changes that. This goes from, hey, we're going to nickel and dime you over like whether Pete Alonso is your best comp or whether it's someone else, to, oh, we are proactively week one of the offseason coming to you and to your agent and saying, we want to get this done. We are willing to pay market rate. You are our guy. Let's do this. Like, the vibe is different in that case.
Yeah. It's also a different vibe for your entire roster too, right? Like, yeah. I do think that, you know, when after the trade deadline, John Schneider spoke to, and a few other coaches spoke to a group of the veteran players or the more experienced players on the roster, said, hey, like, we're not going Chicago White Sox here. We're going to circle back. We're going to be good in 2025. And I think they were grateful to hear that. But I do think there was an element of, okay, well, we'll judge actions and not just words.
As they should. So I do want to touch on the bullpen here because I find it really interesting. I don't need to delineate here just how bad the bullpen has been, but let's just say it's been really bad. And they need it to be a lot better because, and this is going to require outside reinforcements, because it's not like you're just looking at guys who have been like BABIPed all over the place and, oh, their strikeout rates are actually great, but they've just been unlucky on a couple home run balls, or that's not the case. They have, by the peripherals, by the stuff in some cases, by the command, certainly, this is not a group to believe in, unfortunately. So they are going to have to change it. They're going to have to add to it and augment it. And what's interesting to me is if you look at the history of this front office making bullpen upgrades, they've sometimes built good bullpens. 2023 would be the most recent example of that. But they have not spent on relief in a significant way. Their biggest free agent bullpen signing was Jimmy Garcia, $11 million guarantee. Chad Green's option was for $20-plus million, but that was off a guarantee that was for sub-$10 million. Shun Yamaguchi, Kirby Yates, these are some of the bigger relief investments that they have made. So they have understandably and rightfully identified that signing relievers to big-time deals comes with a ton of risk. But I wonder if that changes this offseason because they need this bullpen to be a lot better next year.
Yeah. So there are so many ways that we could dissect this. And I'm going to just throw something a little different at you. And I think this would maybe telling a little bit in which way the Blue Jays go. But Jordan Romano's tendering is, to me, an interesting bellwether. right? Because his salary this year was $7.75 million. Even though he was hurt, he's still going to get a raise. I assume he's going to be around $8 million next year, somewhere around there. That's a big decision, and he didn't pitch this year. His rehab, for whatever reason, didn't allow him to get back in time to pitch a couple of weeks at the end of this year. Do the Blue Jays know what they're getting for that $8 million? And do they end up tendering him? Like, if you're convinced, like, hey, I'm going to spend big on the bullpen, like, then yeah, you go and you definitely tender Jordan Romano. He's homegrown player, Canadian, beloved by fans, been one of the best closers in baseball. But if you're a little uncertain and you're going to sort of play to type, as you mentioned there, Ben, then you're taking that money and you're going to say, hey, well, we can get two guys who maybe can roll the dice on them, or, you know, one and a half guys, and then we'll see what happens. And maybe we can get someone who ends up being, you know, giving us similar type of production. So there are so many fascinating decisions, but to me, a lot of it starts with Jordan Romano. I think we'll get maybe a bit of an indication of which way they go, depending on how they handle him.
Yeah, for sure. And it's that one is, I don't know if you feel differently, but for me, I find that to be such a tough one to kind of prognosticate on from the outside, because we don't know the status. We know he's not expected to return to the majors this year, but we don't know the real status of how the arthroscopic cleanup presumably went well, and he's progressing and they don't need to rush it. But kind of absent health information, it really is tough to understand what they're looking at there.
Yeah, for sure. And again, it's that there are so many reasons. Like, I think that the creative way to handle that would be to non-tender him and like try to do a two-year deal or something like that. Yes. With, you know, a smaller guarantee, but a ton of incentives that could get him to where he should be deservedly, from a financial perspective, if he's pitching right. But again, that, you know, if you take that route, well, suddenly he gets to listen to 29 other teams as well and see what goes on there. So that could play out in a number of different ways. And then, you know, like your bullpen spending is really interesting, because, like, as we talked about, you definitely want a starting pitcher. You've got to get some help for the bullpen. But we haven't talked about this, and this is clear, that even with the young players who have done really nice jobs and have given the Blue Jays a good boost at the end of the year, but also some depth to make some decisions with for the first time in a while, like, you have to augment that lineup. Like, the Blue Jays need at least one, like, very consistent, don't have to worry about it, offensive producer.
Yeah. I think they need two bats.
Right.
Yeah. I think they need one, yeah, like one middle of the order bat. And then I think they need a right-handed hitter who can contribute, you know, defensively, maybe not like a star player, but like a major league right-handed hitter. Just given the struggles that David Schneider's had on fastballs, I just think you would do well to add a right-handed hitter to the organization.
Right. Okay. So let's call it that. So middle of the order bat, not cheap. Right-handed bat, going to cost you some money. It's not going to break the bank.
Yeah.
Right. So let's say you can do that in like at $20 million, and I'm not even sure, you'd probably costing you more, but let's just say for the sake of argument, $20 million. Then you're going to do a starter, so you're probably looking at, say, $10 million there. Like, how much are you spending on the bullpen? On how many bullpen arms do you need?
Right.
So can you do you go big for one reliever, one elite closer, or do you spread the wealth and say, I need four guys who could do this? And, you know, we're already paying Chad Green a lot of money, and he's got ninth inning experience, and he's having a rough end, but he's also first full year after Tommy John. You expect him to be back stronger next year. Chad Green is our closer for now. Like, how you divide the money, like, I think ultimately what the Blue Jays will do is what they usually do. It's, you know, what's going to collect it, what package of moves is going to collectively add the most projected WAR to us, and we'll go that route. But there are a number of different permutations here. And I feel like it'll end up being dictated by what the market allows them to do.
Right. They're not doing this on their own. They have to kind of exist within this whole system. But here's a scenario that I think doesn't feel very Blue Jays to me, would be signing Tanner Scott for 4 years. Let's say it's 56 over four. You get Tanner Scott. Great. You love Tanner Scott. Then he comes into camp and he has elbow soreness and it's an impingement. Okay. He's going to start the season on the IL. Now, all of a sudden, your big, you know, solution, your big offseason expenditures hurt. Like, oh man, this is where I get it. I understand why front offices don't like to consolidate all of this risk and this investment in one relief pitcher who's going to be volatile to begin with and then potentially hurt at some point. I get it. But if there's ever a time, and if you have the money to consider 3 years for Clay Holmes, 3 years for Carlos Estevez, 4 years for Tanner Scott, this might be the year, because you cannot go into next season with a bullpen that's anywhere close. Like, it is, we all agree it has to be better.
So, devil's advocate, would you rather have one guy like that and then a bunch of sort of lottery tickets and what you already have in place? Or would you rather sign, say, three mid-tier guys who give you bullpen depth and give you a real ladder to the closer from the sixth inning onwards? And maybe you don't have that top end certainty and you're going with Chad Green.
Right. And I think, of course, it comes down to the details and who those are and what the prices are.
Of course.
I think either of those can be a good approach. Either of those can be a really good approach. And even if they go out and sign Tanner Scott for $14 million AAV, you still need more. You know, they're not one reliever away, no matter how good that reliever is. But, you know, what's interesting is if they don't go out and sign relievers in free agency, they still need them. So all of a sudden you're depleting your position player depth and potentially prospect depth, which they don't have a ton of. So this is going to be a tricky one for them to thread.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of funny. We started with the idea of sort of predictability. What did the Blue Jays most likely do? And I think what they most likely do is the spread the wealth, as opposed to the one guy who gets the big salary in the bullpen. Like, that's what we've seen them do time and again. The thought is that, you know, with that volatility, you know, one of those guys could end up performing better than the big money closer anyways, and you get more value out of it and there's less risk. And, you know, the more players that you sign, in theory, the less risk that it is, because you get more probability and more protection if somebody gets hurt.
For sure. Shai, I think we should leave it there. Because I've already taken enough of your time today on a rare off day. It's 5-6 months into the season. But thank you so much for making time to join At the Letters today.
A good time as always, and nice to share some of our press box conversations and on the podcast.
I don't think this pod was too dissimilar from what we would say to one another in real life. So I hope that doesn't get us in trouble, but I think that's hopefully a good thing for the listeners.
Yeah, definitely.
Alrighty, that is it for this week on At the Letters. Thank you so much for listening to us throughout the season here on ATL. Thanks as well to our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. And we will talk to you next week on At the Letters.